Tom Woods Show, episode 2206.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, the Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you enjoy the Tom Woods Show, it's time to go to the next level. And next level, Tom Woods, is libertyclassroom.com. This is where my friends and I teach all the stuff you did not get in your conventional education, history, economics, and more, the way it ought to be taught, with all the content they left out or distorted. Check it out at libertyclassroom.com.
Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here. I am returning from an unexpectedly long trip that got a little bit extended because I was just not feeling so well, and I just wanted to stay in New York City an extra day. So I was able to get the hotel to let me stay in the same room, and I got some rest, and I felt well enough. I wasn't feeling well, and the idea of waking up early in the morning and getting on a plane, just awful. But anyway, so that's why the Tom Woods Show week has been off to a bit of a slow start, but we are going to kick into high gear today with our conversation with our guest, Benjamin Abelow, who is the author of the rather provocative new and very short and easily absorbed book, How the West Brought War to Ukraine, Understanding How U.S. and NATO Policies Led to Crisis, War, and the Risk of Nuclear Catastrophe. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
Well, this is about as timely as a book can possibly be, so glad you did it. And there's really no excuse not to read it because it's accessible and it's short. And that's what we need right now in order to get this information out to the public. I want to jump ahead like just to today, even though much of what you're talking about here is history. I want to talk about what's going on right this very minute. Throughout this conflict, we would hear news stories about the Russians suffering terrible setbacks and major victories by the Ukrainians. You think, well, what kind of crazy Western propaganda is this? We all know that's not the case. But recently, it seems like it kind of is the case that the Russians are, in fact, reeling a bit and not exactly in the position they hoped or expected to be in. And so just the other day, Pat Buchanan wrote a column warning about something you warn about in the book, which is the possibility that a cornered Russia, and Putin specifically, could in fact introduce tactical nuclear weapons into this equation, because he's not going to suffer abject humiliation and potential removal from office. So it is not outside at all, outside the realm of possibility to use tactical nukes, which, you know, is not exactly the same thing as launching an all-out nuclear war. But on the other hand, the United States is full of people who wear masks driving around in their cars. This is not a public that appreciates subtlety here. So it's not at all impossible to imagine that escalating into horrific, unspeakable places that are just beyond imagining. And I suspect that's also your analysis of what is at least within the realm of possibility here.
Definitely. Like anyone else, I can't predict the future and I can't assess the actual risk on any kind of statistical basis. But I think that the risk is being underplayed by most of the U.S. foreign policy establishment. I think the risk of escalation is real. And that's ultimately the most frightening aspect of all of this. I mean, of course, there's tremendous danger of huge ongoing expenditures of money and loss of human life on all sides. But ultimately, the risk of nuclear war is the greatest fear.
So let's dig back into the history to talk about how we got here. Now, let's have the standard disclaimer that, of course, it's ridiculous we even have to say this, but unfortunately, we live in such a low IQ society that we have to say we don't support the launching of a war against Ukraine. There are always other options. Everybody knows, should know that. That's obvious enough. But your first two chapters are quite provocatively titled because one is Western Provocations 1990 to 2014. And the other is Western Provocations 2014 to 2022, the second one of which addresses the claim that, well, even if there were provocations, there haven't been any for 8 years, so they can't possibly be a factor in why this invasion occurred. And you're basically saying not so fast to that. But let's start with the first one, all the way back in 1990. So we're talking here about as the Soviet Union is going out of existence and a new international arrangement, you know, that is to say a post-Cold War arrangement is taking shape, there are some verbal assurances being given to Russia about Western or NATO expansion. but they're not put in writing. But yet they do seem to be generally, you know, they appeared sincere when they were said. So situate us right there.
Sure. Maybe as a little additional background, I'll just say that the U.S. and many people in the U.S. and also to some extent in Western Europe have asserted that there never were any promises, or that if there were, they weren't put in writing and therefore they don't matter. It does seem clear that there were promises is somewhat of a strong word. The National Security Archive of George Washington University, in their analyses, they tend to use the word assurances to sort of differentiate between frank actual promises or treaty obligations and what amounted to sort of extensive verbal assurances. So I like that terminology. I think it's clear there were extensive verbal assurances, not just coming from the US, but coming from many players within Western Europe. And although they were never formally said in writing, they were never instantiated in written treaties, the verbal discussions were recorded in all sorts of memoranda, and the documentary evidence supports that. So, for instance, the National Security Archive of George Washington University has 25 documents posted online that bear on this question, and then they do their own analysis. And those documents bear with different degrees of directness or indirectness to the issue. There's a researcher, I believe he's now at Boston University, Joshua Shifrinson, previously in Texas. I think he's an associate professor of political science, who basically went into the archives and then wrote an article in the journal International Security, where he basically concluded that the story the Russians have told, based on his archival research, is correct, that there really were representations that NATO would not expand eastward from West Germany. And this was done as part of a deal because the West wanted to unify Germany under NATO auspices. And to do that, number one, the Soviets would have to agree to it. And number two, they would have to withdraw roughly 400,000 troops out of East Germany. And there were attempts made to mollify Moscow and to try to give them assurances that this would not be taken advantage of. Yet those, of course, were not honored as time progressed.
So your chapter, given that it ends in 2014, what exactly, at least in terms of what we can know for certain, happens in 2014 that would be so significant that your two chapters would divide right there?
Yeah, that's sort of taken as a dividing point for a number of reasons. There was it's sometimes referred to as the Maidan Revolution or the events of Maidan or the quote-unquote revolution of dignity. Other people refer to it as a Western-backed coup. And there are elements of uncertainty about what actually happened. It's completely clear there was some element of popular uprising that had to do, especially within the local confines of the area of Kiev, where there were objections to the Kiev government for not signing a quote-unquote association, economic agreement with the European Union. At the same time, various surveys suggest that there was not an actual majority that wanted that association in place, and that the majority probably wanted to at least maintain an association with Russia. Yet the terms of the EU association agreement did not allow for the maintenance of that. So in any case, my point simply is that there's no question that there was at least a significant minority of people within the Kiev area that strongly wanted that agreement, that strongly objected to the actions of the regime in Kiev, and that was also objecting to what really amounted to widespread corruption in the Yanukovych regime, which is corruption's been widespread really throughout recent Ukrainian history up to the present. So then the question is, things seem to have shifted from what amounted to an actual popular demonstrations and uprising to some extent. I should also add that those popular demonstrations were also strongly supported by the West. So in 2013, for instance, Victoria Nuland, who was then Assistant Secretary of State, I believe it was for European and Eurasian Affairs, and was intimately involved and also interacting with the American ambassador to Ukraine, in a talk she gave in Washington, she just stated publicly, without any circumspection, that the U.S. had given $5 billion to democracy promotion in Ukraine. So the U.S. has played an important hand even in the coordination of those demonstrations. To what extent those demonstrations would have gotten off the ground without that U.S. involvement is very hard to say. But then the question becomes, what actually happened starting in, let's say, especially in February 2014, and really it began in late December 2013, where there really was what occurred much closer to an armed coup, in which the Ukrainian far right, some people will call them neo-Nazis, some people will call them fascists or neo-fascists, but certainly they were ultra-nationalistic and far right, became involved, and there was a physical armed takeover of the government buildings. And it was that actually caused the sitting Ukrainian president, Yanukovych, to flee the country. And then the regime was taken over, the parliament and the presidency was taken over by what's sometimes referred to as the Maidan government or the post-coup government. Now, one other additional complication is that in early February, there was an intercepted or leaked phone call between Victoria Nuland of the U.S. State Department, Assistant Secretary of Defense, and Jeffrey Pyatt, who was then the ambassador to Ukraine, basically discussing who should be taking over. And this was weeks before the actual takeover. And they appear to have put their finger on who they wanted to take over, and that was the Prime Minister for Yatsenyuk they wanted. They didn't want Vitaly Klitschko, the other people. So it does seem that the U.S. had targeted who they wanted to replace the sitting government weeks before it actually occurred. And there's a question of whether the West was actually directly involved in inciting the military action. That becomes very complicated. Some of the most interesting things that have been written about that are written by a Ukrainian-Canadian researcher at the University of Ottawa named Ivan Kachanovsky. And if anyone wants to look that up, he's worth reading. He's published some peer-reviewed research on that that's based actually on primary data that was collected by the post-coup government in Ukraine. So it's not his running around taking cherry-picked interviews. It's taking post-coup Ukrainian government data and then analyzing it seriously for the first time. He's also published some popular articles, but he's worth looking at. I give some links to his particular publications of his in the footnotes, the end notes of my book. But some of his work strongly suggests a Western hand in the violent action as well. But I think it's fair to say that there's some uncertainty about what actually happened. And I think it's fair to say also, I tend to look at it not as a question of a popular uprising or a Western-backed military coup or even a coup by military forces, far-right forces in Ukraine. I tend to look at it as a popular uprising that itself was somewhat supported by the West, that was then superseded by a violent military coup involving Ukrainian far-right that may have also had a Western hand in it, including the CIA or other forces. But there's a lot of uncertainty about actually what happened. But there's no question that the West was intimately involved in the replacement of what was a democratically elected, relatively pro-Russian government with a unconstitutional, pro-Western government. Maybe I've gone on a little bit long with that. Those are some of the key points.
Absolutely. I want to make sure, though, that we cover a point that you make early on where you say that the subject of NATO expansion has been treated so abstractly that it obscures what the actual nature of the Russian concern is. Because I've heard quote-unquote libertarians say that NATO is a peaceful organization, entirely defensive in nature. Nobody expects NATO to launch an invasion of Russia. So in a sense, who the heck cares the extent to which NATO expands? Why would anyone care unless they were up to something? That's what I've heard. So what exactly is the nature of the Russian concern?
Yeah, I would say it's several fold. And I four separate thoughts popped into my mind as you asked that question. I hope I can parse them all out in my thinking and remember them as I'm speaking. But the most basic concern is that NATO, by its very nature, is a military alliance. And while it's certainly true, especially early on with the expansion, it was not seen explicitly as a military threat to Russia. With the passage of time, NATO became increasingly seen by Russia as a military threat. And that's legitimate. Ultimately, NATO is purely a military, well, I don't want to say purely, but largely a military alliance, a defensive alliance that was set up, I believe it was in 1949, if I'm not mistaken, that really was designed to counter the communist Soviet threat. So that's one aspect, that simply in formal terms, it is a military alliance. Second, you just need to look at the geographic location. You know, the U.S. has what's referred to as a Monroe Doctrine. I believe it was 1823. The document was first formulated, then became known as the Monroe Doctrine, where the U.S. asserted security claims over really effectively the whole Western Hemisphere. And any potential opponent that placed its forces within the Western Hemisphere knew that it was doing something extremely provocative and in some respects crossing a red line. So if one looks for a second at how the U.S. would react to and this point has been made by Colonel Douglas McGregor and many others, that if the Russians, for instance, or the Chinese set up an alliance with something on our border, the way Ukraine exists on Russia's border, and then brought in military hardware and then did drills from that location, actually practiced destroying targets within the United States, I mean, the U.S. would go bonkers. And that leads to a sort of a broader point. It's also part of the response to your question, which is that ultimately every country does, and with legitimate reason, does not simply take the assertions of the other country's intentions as the gold standard. What they do is they look at the hardware on the ground, they look at the military capacity, the technical hardware capacity, they look at the geographic location, and they look at what training exercises are going on and whether those training exercises can be used for offensive purposes. And that's certainly been going on. Now, what's complicated about the Ukraine situation, and rightly so, people assert, well, it's not at all clear when or whether Ukraine would be coming into NATO. The West asserted unequivocally that Ukraine and Georgia would be coming into NATO, and they made that assertion in 2008. But partly due to resistance from the Europeans, especially the French and the Germans, they've not taken immediate or active steps. And some people have asserted, well, Ukraine wouldn't be coming in for the next 5 or 10 years anyway. What's the problem? Well, part of the problem is that people often inordinately focus just on this question of NATO. But the reality is that irrespective of NATO and irrespective of whether Ukraine ever comes into NATO, the West, and especially the United States, has a whole series of bilateral relations, treaties, and interactions with Ukraine, and has also coordinated multilateral interactions. What I mean is interactions whereby the U.S. military and the Ukrainian military have closely coordinated their activities, and the U.S. has also helped coordinate similar bilateral between Ukraine and other Western European countries. So that even outside of the NATO framework, and whether or not that framework is ever brought into actual play, the NATO countries, led by the U.S., have established close relationships and have gone very far in arming Ukraine and forming it into a Western outpost on Russia's border. There have been billions of dollars of arms coming in, and these arms are also, the interactions are not just the military hardware per se, but bringing Ukraine and the Ukrainian military up to NATO standards. So that what's been going on is a kind of de facto NATOization of Ukraine, bringing it up to NATO standards, making it effectively interoperable with the Western military framework, and all of that right on Russia's border. So I do not dismiss the NATO concern at all as an independent concern. I think it's a legitimate concern. I think the Russians have legitimate security concerns that the West has never stated that they will not bring NATO in. But I think that concern is also overblown. And some people simply do not either recognize or are eager to dismiss the entire concern about Western encroachment, military encroachment on Russia's border, by focusing solely on the NATO question and setting aside the whole question of extra NATO military encroachments, which, because these involve bringing Ukraine up to NATO standards and arming it with NATO standard hardware, it sort of blurs the distinction, and it in some ways makes the whole question of NATO membership an arbitrary one. And the real one becomes, let's forget about NATO, let's forget about bilateral arrangements, let's forget about multilateral arrangements. The real question is, what's the hardware? What's the situation on the ground? What's the training level? What's the level of interoperability with the Western forces? And what are the stated, what are the other levels of involvement with the country? So I think that's how I would try to sum it up.
Well, not to mention the U.S. regime, and probably all governments around the world, have ways of making offensive operations sound defensive. In fact, isn't that what all regimes do, right?
Yeah, I think that's very true. And even if we leave aside the intentions that, let's say, you know, one person might be very suspicious of what are the U.S. intentions. Well, the U.S. really wants to do offensive potential, and they want to threaten Russia with an offensive attack in order to, you know, who knows what, for whatever reason. But even if that's not the case, and let's assume, let's give the U.S. or Washington the benefit of the doubt, let's say that it's the intention is purely defensive. The fact is, you know, there's very little that distinguishes offensive and defensive weapons at a certain point. This is sometimes called the security dilemma. When a potential opponent takes steps that they perceive as defensive, yet can have offensive potential, the other side will almost automatically perceive that offensive potential and then take steps that they perceive as defensive, which themselves may be perceived by the original side as offensive. So it kind of cuts both ways. It's very hard to know what the actual U.S. intentions are, just as it can be hard for us to know exactly what the Russian offensive objectives are. But even if we assume benign intentions, the very fact of the hardware on Russia's border, which has offensive potential, can be extremely threatening. Let me give you a specific example. So the Baltic state of Estonia on Russia's western border, NATO has carried out, this was carried out in 21, two sets of live fire rocket exercises whereby NATO launched, these are tactical conventional weapons with a range of about 185 miles. They launched those 70 miles from Russia's border with live warheads that were specifically designed to simulate an attack on air defense targets within Russia. Now, that targeting was done ostensibly with, and perhaps very much the case, with the idea that if Russia ever attacked Western Europe, that the West could blunt that assault by attacking air defense targets inside Russia. But of course, from a Russian perspective, we're talking about NATO practicing what amount to an offensive attack on their own air defense systems inside Russian territory. And that's got to be extremely frightening to Russia. And sort of to make things even worse, these practice drills were launched in Estonia, which is a country that's far to the east of what the original assurances were made. So here you have, you know, roughly 1,000 miles to the east of where the original prescription of NATO expansion was, in a country that was, Russia was told, that Moscow was told, will not be brought into NATO. The country is brought into NATO, and then potentially offensive attacks are practiced from that territory. It's kind of a double whammy. So, you know, whatever one thinks of American intentions, and even if one puts the most benign interpretation on it, it takes a certain kind of person not to see that from a Russian perspective, based on their own perception of legitimate national security concerns, that what's been going on is extremely threatening. And again, the image of, you know, how the U.S. might respond if similar actions were taken based in Canada or based in Mexico. And of course, all we need to do is look at the Cuban Missile Crisis and see, and of course, that was not directly on the border. It really lets us see to what extent some of the assumptions that the U.S. military planners take for granted, having to do with the placement of military weapons on one's border, those are just disregarded with respect to Russia. And steps are taken that have got to be seen as extremely dangerous and provocative to Russia that are, you know, kind of taken with very little concern by NATO countries. And then, as if it's a good enough response, the response that's given is, those are not our intentions, which may well be the case. But, you know, how blind do you have to be to not see the threat that that quote-unquote defensive posture can also pose to Russia in an offensive way?
Well, that's why your third chapter, putting the shoe on the other foot, is so important, because you could instantly see that the United States would not tolerate this stuff for 5 minutes. The United States would not tolerate any of this for 5 minutes. The very stuff that, you know, the apologists for the regime try to brush away as, oh, that's not a big deal, Russia shouldn't overreact. they themselves would, to say the least, would slightly overreact if they were put in this situation. And I can't get away from the war in Iraq in 2003, which was openly an offensive war. I mean, come on. They obviously invented the story of the weapons of mass destruction. We know all about the corruption of the intelligence agencies and all that. So that was an offensive war, but they actually were able to take a country like Iraq and make it seem as if that was the aggressor and that the United States, the greatest military power in the world, was the put upon victim that just had to restore the scales of justice in the world. If they could get away with that and depicting that as a defensive war, they can make anything out to be a defensive war and still maintain the pure innocence of NATO. And again, could you imagine if the Russians were on the Mexican border or Canadian border and saying, look, we're just trying to keep an eye on the U.S. because it's been at war pretty much nonstop since World War II somewhere in the world. And we have no offensive intentions of our own, but we just want to keep an eye on this huge warmongering regime. Well, I don't think they would accept that.
Yeah.
And by the way, it doesn't have to be a full-blown, you know, NATO invasion of Russia, but what it could be is the undermining of Russian friends, the installation of hostile regimes on Russia's border. So it doesn't have to actually be an outright invasion. It could be, there are a lot of things short of that that could be accomplished that would be unacceptable to Russia, but also unacceptable, let's be honest, unacceptable to the United States if it were done to them.
Yeah, I agree 100% with what you just said, John. And I think I would add to that that, you know, one of the things I've struggled with in trying to look at this is exactly what are Russia's intentions and exactly what are U.S. intentions. Let me focus on the U.S. intentions for a second. I suspect that it's not an either or. I suspect there are people in the Washington foreign policy establishment, in the military itself, in the think tank world, who basically see what the U.S. is doing and what NATO is doing as really defensive, and that they are, let's call them well-intentioned people that I would perceive as misguided because they're not taking adequate cognizance of how Russia can legitimately perceive the threat. I think on the other hand, there are also people who really are trying to destabilize Russia and are trying to create pressures on Russia that, in line with what you're saying, these wouldn't have to be an actual threat of a full-on invasion, but that would be some kind of destabilization or what's sometimes referred to as causing Russia to overextend itself in terms of its military spending, in terms of political actions and things of this nature. So, yeah, I think your point that one does not have to have a maximalist perception of NATO or Western intentions in order to see even less than benign intentions. There can be attempts to destabilize and attempt to get Russia to overextend itself in different ways.
Now a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp. I think we've all been in a situation where things seem to be going so wrong in our lives that we get focused on the problems themselves rather than coming up with solutions to get us out of them. It can be hard to train your brain to stay in problem-solving mode when you're faced with a bunch of challenges. Instead, we become obsessive, we catastrophize, we think about the worst possible outcomes, and none of this does a single thing to make our lives better. It only makes things worse. Well, a therapist can help you become a better problem solver, making it easier to accomplish your goals. And I do not hesitate at all to tell you that I have made use of therapy, and in particular, of BetterHelp. Like everyone, I've gone through some rough times over the years, and BetterHelp matched me up with the perfect specialist who heard what I was saying and helped to guide me through. It is a great way to get rid of stress, to find emotional healing, to help with anxiety and depression. And if you're thinking of giving therapy a try, BetterHelp really is a great option. It's convenient, accessible, affordable, entirely online. You just fill out a brief survey, they match you with a therapist, and you can switch therapists anytime. When you want to be a better problem solver, therapy can get you there. Visit betterhelp.com/woods today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/woods. Now I'm going to ask you the question nobody really knows the answer to. So do not feel any shame if you say I have to punt on this one. But, and obviously this is a question that anybody listening to this 10 years from now, they'll know what the answer is. But what are some, other than the use of the massive escalation, but the use of even tactical nukes, what are some scenarios What's a bad scenario that doesn't involve nukes? And what's a good scenario? I mean, and again, by good, I mean least bad, by which this all kind of comes to an end.
Well, let me approach it this way. In April, I believe it was April. I don't think it was March. I think it was April. The Ukrainian government and the Russian government was meeting, and I believe it was actually Zelensky, and I think it was the Russian foreign minister, met in Turkey under Turkish auspices to try to negotiate some kind of peaceful resolution to the situation. And apparently, I haven't seen it yet, but I've heard reference to it, that this has now been explicitly stated by Fiona Hill in the most recent issue of Foreign Affairs magazine journal, that the agreement was being moved towards and that it would have involved basically, in important respects, a withdrawal of Russia to the pre-invasion lines, but would also involve a neutral status for Ukraine. Some of the details I don't follow completely, but in any case, the basic pattern would probably involve something like neutral status to Ukraine, some agreement about how to handle the status of autonomous regions in the Donbass, would probably involve the retention of Crimea by Russia, or some very supportable regrouping where Russia maintained uncontested control of the Sevastopol naval base, which is their warm water Black Sea port and central to their security, which has been one of their deep concerns, and then basically having exchange, and then probably some kinds of perhaps Western-backed assurances that if Russia did invade under these circumstances, that the U.S. might become involved again. And this actually seemed that this was actually what was being moved towards in Turkey between Zelensky and the Russian government. Now, what seems to have happened is that British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, shortly after that, came to visit Zelensky in Ukraine, in Kiev, and basically said to him, you may want peace and you may be ready for a ceasefire and peaceful agreement, but we, the West, are not. This was, you know, done under the stated authority of Johnson, but it seems very likely that the U.S., that Johnson would not have taken such a step without U.S. support, or at least a willingness to go along with it. So the point there is simply that it seems like there was a movement in this direction, and there might well have been this. In fact, there's an article in the Ukrainian newspaper, Ukrainian Pravda. This is not the Russian Pravda. This is Ukrainian Pravda back in April that actually specifically stated this and described Johnson's trip and looked at the two reasons why Ukraine did not form a peaceful conclusion to this with Russia back in April. And one of the two reasons was that Johnson showed up and said that you may want peace, but we don't want peace. Don't do it. The second one had to do with the atrocities in Bucha, or the claimed atrocities. This itself is somewhat of a vexed question exactly what happened there. But that was the other element. And again, this was published in Ukrainian Pravda. You know, I could try to get you the link on that. You have to run it through Google Translate or some other translation program to read it, because it's written, it's not in English, but it's quite clear what the situation was. So I think to return to your basic question, I think I would frame it like this, that as soon as one begins to shift the narrative a little bit and begins to look at the Russian invasion, this is not, and I'll put it in a tentative way for people who are not certain of what they think is going on, this is not necessarily a Hitler-like Russian invasion, unprovoked, seeking to expand Russia, Russian territory, and quote-unquote reestablish the Soviet empire. This may well be a defensive step taken by Russia trying to preempt the ongoing expansion of a Western military outpost right on their border. As soon as one allows for that possibility, and if one goes further and says it seems quite likely that's the scenario that was at play, then the possibility of negotiation, compromise becomes quite possible, taking into account legitimate security concerns of both Ukraine and Russia, centrally and Russia, which right now have been utterly dismissed, trying to reach a peaceful resolution and settling things down. So I actually titled the introduction to my book, it's, you know, it's called Introduction, : How the Narrative Drives the War. As soon as one has the narrative that this is basically Hitler reincarnated, which effectively is a narrative that one often hears these days, both in Washington and in the popular media and in the mind of many citizens, as soon as one has that narrative, well, then, of course, any rapid negotiated end to the war is seen as a sort of Munich-style appeasement. Whereas if one shifts the narrative and allows for or even thinks that a different narrative is the most likely understanding of events, then all of a sudden, a negotiated settlement with some element of compromise, taking into account legitimate security concerns on all sides, is no longer seen as appeasement, no longer seen as a wish-fulfilling fantasy or wishful thinking, but instead becomes seen as an attempt to settle a difficult situation in a way that takes into account everyone's security concerns. And I think that kind of shift in the narrative can radically shift the range of possibilities and basically lead to a fairly rapidly negotiated diplomatic compromise. But this is quite different from what the U.S. position is right now. Since April, since, quote unquote, it was the secret visit between U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken and the U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Ashton, publicly stated after they returned from Ukraine that the new objective, or one of the new objectives now, is to weaken Russia to make it incapable of launching another, you know, offensive war like this again. Now, of course, from Russia's perspective, this is extremely threatening, but when you weaken Russia's military, if that were to be the case, you know, what you're also talking about is the weakening of the military to the extent that it becomes impossible for them to defend themselves against an invasion, which comes back exactly to this security dilemma concern and exactly to this offensive-defensive threat that you and I were both raising. So right now, from an American perspective, because there's now this independent objective of weakening Russia, which requires an ongoing long-term war to destroy Russian military capacity on, quote-unquote, battlefield Ukraine, the idea of a rapidly negotiated diplomatic compromise is, I won't even say it's off the table. It's not even something that Washington wants because it's incompatible with their currently stated objective. This is all crazy. It's also compatible with the fact, I really haven't been tracking the news in the last couple of weeks, but at least until a week or two ago, there was no direct contact between Anthony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, and the Foreign Ministry of Russia. The only discussion that was going on had to do with negotiation over some kind of prisoner exchange for the American basketball player who was arrested there on drug charges, but nothing having to do with ending this conflict. And that again fits with, if your war is driven by a certain narrative and a certain explanation of how events evolved and what Russian intentions are, and a certain dismissal of any possible legitimate national security concerns on Russia's part, well, that leads to certain conclusions, and that leads to certain types of actions and certain refusals to engage in diplomatic solutions.
Well, we're going to leave it there, and I'll strongly recommend people read what you've written here. The book is How the West Brought War to Ukraine, Understanding How U.S. and NATO Policies Led to Crisis, War, and the Risk of Nuclear Catastrophe. Ben, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you very much.
All right, folks. Tomorrow, the forbidden Paul Gottfried returns to the Tom Woods Show. I'll see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.